Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former all-pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Audio.
Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Good to be with you.
This is the meeting everyone has been waiting for. Wednesday, the Fed Open Markets Committee meeting, and they will decide how many basis points they will shave off the interest rates. Your thoughts?
Yeah, this is absolutely the one that we've all been talking about, and somebody's going to be right, somebody's going to be wrong. The discussion now, and it's really close to 50-50, is will it be 25 basis points or 50? You have some people getting involved who shouldn't, including Senator Warren writing a letter and saying, you know, they need to do 75. The Fed should be exempt from political influence, and I think largely they have been. But yeah, for sure. On Wednesday, we'll see the first drop in rates. My best guess is 25, but who knows? Could easily be 50. There's some nervousness that if they do 50, it'll signal that they feel like the economy's in trouble, and 25 would be more steady as she goes. So, yeah, be very interesting to see what happens on Wednesday.
But shouldn't it be devoid of all of that? I mean, you know, what evidence does Elizabeth Warren bring forward to justify a 75 basis point cut?
Elizabeth Warren is one of those people that is often wrong but never uncertain. And yeah, I would deeply discount almost everything she says economically. And it really is, it is improper for politicians to get involved with the Federal Reserve. And Jerome Powell's been very emphatic about that. He was asked, you know, what is the effect of politics? He said, we don't consider that. That's not something we do. We just don't do it. And that's really what it has to be, because politically, it's always going to be something that you'll want the Fed to do things that help your administration, regardless of the effects later on. And it would cause the world to lose confidence in our monetary system. So I think it was bad form to write the letter. Certainly, I don't think the Fed's going to pay attention to it, but it's just an indication of bad judgment that you'd even suggest that the Fed do a 75 basis point cut. For one thing, that would really signal that the Fed thought the market was, that the economy was in deep trouble and needed an instant shot of adrenaline. So that would, in my mind, be the worst possible thing you could do.
Obviously, because folks believe that this action that would be taken by the open market is actually good, an action that reflects that the economy's in a good shape, right? As opposed, and it's really the opposite effect. I don't know if I'm explaining this right, but you are saying this correctly.
No, you are. A lot of times people get excited about Fed rate cuts and they say, gee, the Fed's cutting rates. And sometimes it's because there's weakness in the economy. In this case, the Fed had to deal with rapid inflation. You know, there was a tremendous amount of government spending, a tremendous amount of snapback in spending, a big deficit increase. And the Fed had to raise rates to slow inflation. So rates are higher than the normal rate and higher than sort of the neutral rate. There's a word that economists use that nobody else does, which is R-starred. And it is the normal non-inflationary, non-deflationary interest rate. And the interesting thing is you don't know what it is until you get there. It's sort of, yeah, we'll know what it looks like when we arrive. It doesn't stimulate the economy. It doesn't make the economy shrink. It's the neutral rate. And there's a lot of debate professionally on what that rate needs to be. A lot of, in the old days, the typically the inflation rate would be 2 and the Fed funds rate would be 4. So you'd think, okay, that's a neutral rate that doesn't stimulate or shrink. And ideally, you want to see them get back to that neutral rate. But getting back, if you're at the neutral rate and go down, then it means that there is something wrong with the economy. When you're above the neutral rate, it means that inflation is coming down and you can safely come down a bit. And I think that's where we are right now.
And Elizabeth Warren's not the only politician that has opined. It's both sides of the aisle, right? Because a lot of times the action that's taken by the Fed may work contrary to what they believe the monetary policy should be. But what their belief is of no moment, that's what the Fed is charged with doing, right? They don't get it right all the time. No one does.
No, and I think this time they may have done a pretty good job. Got to give them credit for potentially engineering the soft landing in the face of a lot of different global challenges. But realistically, almost every politician wants lower rates. Donald Trump wanted lower rates. George Bush wanted lower rates. Jimmy Carter wanted lower rates, and so did Bill Clinton and Joe Biden. So, you know, it's a normal predisposition if you're a politician and want rates to be lower, because then people have lower borrowing costs, lower mortgage costs. The Fed has to manage that, because if they let inflation get out of control, the results are disastrous for the economy. And that's really the Fed's fear, is that inflation expectations become, to use Jerome Powell's word, unmoored. And when people think there's just no end in sight to inflation, then lots of bad things occur. So, once again, I'd say the politicians are doing what they always do, you know, left, right, and center. They want lower rates. The Fed is doing a pretty good job of ignoring the politics. And I hope that they are indeed engineering the soft landing that really would be better for the economy for all of us.
Guy, there are a lot of people that there's blame being placed all over. Some sectors have higher inflation rates than others. We've seen that in food prices, and now we have, you know, allegations of price gouging. I don't really necessarily believe that, but for the benefit of the listening audience, why is it that some sectors of the economy experience higher inflation than others?
Well, you have a giant, diverse economy. We're incredibly fortunate to have the largest economy in the world, and each part of the economy has different inputs. And if you look at different commodities, they're subject to different things. You have crops like soybeans and wheat, and they're subject to weather. So depending on what the weather is, the soybean and wheat prices can go up or down. We also have some imports from foreign countries, and that makes a difference. So if you have a crop, you can end up with different inflation based upon weather or based on imports. Manufactured goods, it depends on what your labor costs are. If your labor costs are high, if you have a challenge getting skilled workers, your cost could go up. If you're constrained by supply, you can't get the necessary raw materials, your cost can go up. And so you have a lot of different pressures. In the technology sector, computing power has gone down for decades. You know, the amazing things that a computer can do today, in the old days, you'd have to spend millions of dollars to get that sort of computing power. So efficiency can make that prices go down sometimes. So it's a combination of inputs, labor, efficiency, and then external factors, you know, like weather, that all go together to result in the price of a good. And really, I just do not believe there's any price gouging in the food business. It's a very thin margin business. There are lots and lots of suppliers. The grocers are always looking for, you know, different vendors that give different prices. And, you know, we see that in New Orleans. You know, in addition to all of our great local groceries, you have the out-of-towners like the Aldis that are bringing in a discount model. So, you know, I think that's just an excuse when people are unhappy with the reality of where they are. But the cost of goods really is a complex input-based equation and the market economy does get to a fair price, far better than any other system.
Is one of the considerations for the open market committee on Wednesday when they meet this kind of wage, our wages as it relates to the inflation index and where we are? It seems as though, you know, that gap or that delta, I think, is maybe been reported as being as high as 3 to 4% at the present time. Your thoughts?
Yeah, but the wage situation is complex, and that's the one reason that the Fed will not leave rates the same, is they're seeing softening in the demand for labor. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics has botched the numbers, unfortunately, and they've had to revise them down pretty significantly. So it means the labor market is weaker than was originally forecast. And you and I have talked about this on a number of different shows, that there was more weakness in the labor markets than the statistics were indicating. But because of that, because of the shrinking number of people that are getting new jobs, because of the number of companies that are looking at layoffs, the Fed definitely feels that this is a time where there's a greater risk of higher unemployment than there is to higher inflation. So we're definitely focused on employment numbers right now. And the softness is something that really does concern the Federal Reserve.
But the wage increase, the percentage of the wage increase, is not keeping up with the percentage of inflation, right?
It depends.
That's true. I mean, some sectors they have and others haven't.
Yes, again, some people are doing well, some people are losing. You know, if you're locked into a contract, you can end up stuck for quite a while if you're not, or if you're in an area where you have a surplus of labor, you may not be getting wage increases. On the other hand, if you have an in-demand skill, you can see your pay going up faster than inflation. So there really is a mix around the country. It just depends on what market you're in. The other thing is, if you're in a shrinking state or city, wages tend to be stagnant or decline. If you're in a growing city, you have more demand for construction, more demand for everything, and that tends to push wages up a bit.
I saw a report somewhere where the, you know, food service, hospitality industry wages, the wage index was growing faster than the inflation index, which should bode well for New Orleans, right?
Yeah, because we're definitely a hospitality business. We're going to have two wonderful opportunities to showcase ourselves. We've got the Taylor Swift concerts, which are a big, big economic deal. That should fill all the hotels, restaurants, and bars. And then the Super Bowl. And to the extent that those do, and to the extent that we're able to bump wages for the servers and all the people in the hospitality industry, that's a great thing for New Orleans and something that I think will happen over the next, you know, 4 to 6 months.
Let's talk about the state of Louisiana. There was a recent report by the Tax Foundation that came out that said that we continue to lose population in the state, and that our gross income numbers are on the slide as well, which is kind of interesting because most of the other southern and southeastern states have shown gains. This continues to be a problem for Louisiana, right?
Oh, absolutely. We're the only southern state that's shrinking. Last year, we lost 11,000 people. By contrast, Florida is gaining 1,000 a day. I mean, think about that, 1,000 per day.
Yeah.
You know, Texas, a similar number. And so what we have are really thriving states. And then a state that has all the potential in the world, but is really not living up to its potential. I'm guardedly optimistic. I think we're making some changes. We have a lot of things that put us behind. You know, we just went through the Francine thing. The weather is a challenge. People are reluctant to locate in a storm area, but that hasn't stopped Florida from growing. The other thing is our tax system is really a mess. We collect, and when you when the Tax Foundation looks at it, we're right in the middle of the states, you know, somewhere in the high 20s, not too high, not too low. But we look expensive, and we look expensive because we have a high sales tax and a high income tax. And so when people are looking at a state like Texas with a zero or Florida with a zero income tax, they look cheaper. But when you look at their collections as a percent of the state GDP, they're about the same as ours. So they're collecting the same money, but in a more transparent way. And if we can get to a cleaner, simpler system, you know, eliminate all the exemptions on the sales tax and then lower the rate, get to a higher property tax and then a lower income tax, if not a zero tax, I think that would help a lot, because those are challenges that really are difficult to overcome, and it's been tough for the economic development folks to lure people because of that.
Did you say from an expense side that we are similar to other states? Because it seems to me if we go to a 0% or no state income taxes, we have to cut the size of state government, right?
Well, we have several areas in state government that are inefficient, and DOTD is probably the worst. You have an awful lot of folks there, and it's not productive compared to other states. If you compare, you know, miles of road completed compared to workers and salaries, we're way at the low end of productivity. So there is room for some cuts and some efficiency in state government. And then what Texas has done is they've gone to a higher income tax, and that, I mean, not higher income, a higher real estate tax and property tax. So there is a way to do it. You have to shuffle it a bit. There's no magic way of saying we're just going to cut this and have no change. One of the challenges, too, is the way we've set up our legislature is there's very little flexibility for elected officials, and they end up stuck having to cut health care and education because everything else is in a dedicated fund and constitutionally protected. And one of the things that would really be helpful is if we would go back to a system and say, look, we're undedicating the funds. We're going to let the legislature do what we hire them to do. We get to vote on them every few years. It's their job to allocate money. But because they're handcuffed, we end up cutting things that are very, very detrimental to the state. Sometimes we'll cut education, and that really hurts because if you don't have an educated workforce, you can't compete. And then the other counterproductive cut is sometimes we'll cut at health care and lose the federal match. So we're literally losing $2 for one in order to balance a budget that's gotten out of control. And a lot of that goes back to excessive dedications. And that goes back to the days when, you know, voters just didn't trust the legislators. And I think we have to give them a little more credit. You know, most of them have their state's best interests at heart, and let them have a little more control so that they can do what's in the best interest of the state.
It seems as though the pressure is going to be mounting on them as well, because recently a number of federal elected leaders, congressional leaders and alike have been sending the message to the states, you need to stop coming up here begging for money because there is none. You know, when we talk about the debt that we have now, I think it's right at $36 trillion and growing, that they just can't continue to fund the desires of state government.
No, you're exactly right. And unfortunately, we're in a very difficult situation because the debt is bigger this year. The deficit is bigger this year than it was last. And there are really no plans to deal with it from either party. And there are no plans to deal with Social Security. And we're in campaign season. And in the campaign season, each party is sort of trying to outbid the other on what they're going to do and how they're going to give some freebie or some benefit to different groups of folks. And neither side wants to talk about the fact that we're spending 27% of GDP and collecting about 19%. And we just can't do that forever. you know, it will come to an end. It'll come to an ugly end, either with inflation or very high taxes or a big cut in spending.
You know, there's been a lot of chatter about giving away money and a lot of chatter about not collecting taxes on income earned. I mean, you know, the most recent former President Donald Trump talking about not taxing Social Security sounds really good to me at age 66, but I'm not sure how the country affords that.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem. All of these things poll well. Not taxing Social Security will get over 50% of the people say that's a great idea. And I understand, I really do, but you also need to balance that with, if we don't do that, then we have to either tax something else or cut some spending. And when you start making it a choice and having a decision, then it becomes a different discussion. Because right now it's, you know, which one of the free toys in the basket do you want to take home? And there is no rationing. There is no there's no fiscal discipline. Now, eventually, fiscal discipline will come by the markets. But when that happens, it can be really ugly, and that could result in inflation and interest rates going right back up. You know, we're talking about rates going down. If people lose confidence in our ability to manage the debt, rates will go up, and there will be nothing the Fed can do about it.
Guy, but don't we get the sense? I mean, I get the sense that the federal government is probably, if we cut 30% of the federal government from an employment standpoint, and I know we can't do this, but just for argument's sake, next year, I don't know that we would miss a blip, quite frankly. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to me how large that we've got, how many new agencies have been created. You know, the regulatory side in this country has run amok. You know, you can't move a rock that's 18 inches in diameter from the bank of a stream without getting a permit. I mean, it's almost to the point of being ridiculous these days. And it just seems to get larger and larger and larger. Let's pick up the conversation there. We got to get to a break. We'll start there when we come back. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and Text line. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former All-Pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey.
Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. And Guy, let's pick up the conversation where I suggested it just seems to me that our federal government's bloated. We could cut there. We're involved in too many different things. It's too large. And really, it's not even manageable anymore in many respects.
Well, clearly the size has gotten well beyond what many people ever thought it would. And one of the challenges is the federal government spends a tremendous amount of money, but it doesn't spend it particularly well. And we'll start with health care. you know, we spend about $15,000 per capita in the United States on healthcare. The rest of the developed world spends about $7,000. Now, you would say, well, okay, if we have the greatest healthcare in the world, then maybe it's worth spending more money, effectively twice as much. But our life expectancy is 76 years. The other developed country average is 82 years. So we're spending more, getting less. And what we're not demanding is accountability and effectiveness in our federal programs. The idea is if there's a program and it sounds good like health and we all want to be healthy, we just need to spend more money. But we're spending more money than the other developed countries and getting a worse outcome. And I think that's one of the frustrations. A lot of voters really have a challenge expressing what their frustration is, but I think that's part of it. They just feel like government is taking a lot of money and spending it, but not very wisely. And healthcare is one of the perfect examples. We just spend way too much money, but get way too little for it. So there's certainly significant room for improvement and efficiency in healthcare in America.
And over the years, we've seen it on the defense spending side as well. Toilets costing 25 times what you can get it for at Lowe's or Home Depot. Screws being off the charts. You know, I mean, just so many different examples there as well. No accountability, just government money. We'll pay it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Defense Department spending is a perfect example of things that are just out of control. And one of the challenges is we've been so nervous about somebody taking advantage of the government and doing a selected vendor that we have a procurement process that just weeds out competition. And there are only a few people that can get through that mire of the procurement process. And when they do, they charge too much. It'd make tremendous sense for the federal government to say, look, anything we can buy off the shelf from, you know, Walmart or Tractor Supply, we're going to buy. And that's the price we're going to pay. We're not going to pay a special beefed up government price. And then we're going to shop more effectively because we're clearly spending a lot more than we need. And the challenge is, you know, we're in a different scenario. We have incredibly expensive weapon systems, and they're very, very capable. But what's happening is our opponents are creating really cheap drones. And if a swarm of really cheap drones can wipe out $1 billion airplane, that's a pretty good deal for the opposition and not a great deal for us. So there's a lot of room for improvement in defense spending, and we have to recognize the new reality of where we are. And if you're in an area of a drone swarm, having a few incredibly expensive weapon systems is not going to be a productive way. And hopefully we never have to fight a major war, but it could be a real challenge going forward.
I mean, at some point, I guess the public has to speak up, put more pressure on our congressional leaders, because, you know, as we listen to what's being said during the course of this election process, it just seems to me nothing is aligning. I mean, it's just I don't know where we get to from here. We're hearing reports, you know, Goldman Sachs says this about this one's plan, and Goldman Sachs comes out and says, well, that was exaggerated. And others, you know, what's the group at Penn? Wharton is, you know, said this about this plan, and they come out and said, that's not exactly what we said. And it just seems to me that everyone is kind of the same mindset. They're saying nothing of what anything that's being proposed or what limited information that we have actually gets us out of the doldrums that we sometimes find ourselves in.
No, and the challenge right now is, let's imagine if you and I were running the campaigns and flip a coin, whichever side you're on, but we poll the voters and the voters say, okay, we want no taxes on Social Security, no taxes on tips. We want, you know, lower cost here. Never does anyone say, we're very concerned about the deficit and the financial trajectory. So So we design our campaigns based on what the voters tell us they're interested in, which is lower taxes, and then the all-time favorite, taxing billionaires so that nobody else has to pay. You know, we're going to make Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett pay for everything. And what people don't realize is the very rich people could only cover the deficit for 1 year, and then they're out of money. And when voters are told by politicians, don't worry about a thing, we're just going to tax the billionaires, that's not really true. And unfortunately, the fact-checking has been a little weak on that. And both campaigns are guilty of not looking at the financial consequences and the fiscal balance. And unfortunately, the voters don't seem to care. You remember Ross Perot when he was running on the deficit. People actually cared about that and voted based on we need to balance the budget. And son of a gun, when the American people demanded it and then Bill Clinton got in office, he balanced the budget. It can be done. But the American people have to want it to be done and to vote for people that will do it.
Well, it's almost as if our leadership and elected officials have become lazy, because the easiest way to get elected is just promise the world. You know, it's like,
exactly.
You want that? Sure, we can give you that. You want this? Yeah, we'll give you that too. I mean, what we have now is a collective group of chameleons. They will say anything, do anything in order to get elected. And they stand for very little. You know, it's hard to stand for fiscal responsibility, right? Because in every decision that's made, as you well know, and you say this all the time, they're winners, they're losers. But that's just a fact of life, is it not?
It is. The other reality, and this is the tough thing for politicians, is the support for good government is an inch deep. The support for an entrenched payoff to a special interest is a mile deep. So you've got an inch deep and a mile wide, or a mile deep and an inch wide. Well, the people that are affected will really care. They'll really lobby. They'll really fight. And then the other people, yeah, they're in favor of good government, but they may or may not show up to vote. They may not be that involved. And they can get overwhelmed by the interests that really want to be protected. So it's tough politically. You have to win an election in order to make a change, and you've got to balance telling the people the truth and actually getting elected. Now, I do think the American people are smarter than the politicians give them credit for. And I think
finish your point. I'm sorry.
I was just saying, if either party would step up and say, look, folks, we have a real problem. We're spending 27% of GDP. We can't keep doing it. And we've never collected, even during World War II, more than 20% of GDP. So we have a big gap of spending versus income. We're not going to radically raise taxes, but we are going to essentially slow the rate of growth significantly, and over a period of 8 to 10 years, we're going to get it back in balance. It's not going to be easy, but we can do it. We'll make it more efficient, and we'll all be better off in the long run. And I think voters would be receptive to that message.
I always get the text, you know, when we talk about this, the rich are not paying their proportionate share. What share of the U.S. population, and I think you have this number available to you because I think you've mentioned it before, pays no income taxes at all in this country?
It approaches 50% when you look at the earned income tax credit and the refunds that people get. One of the questions that I always wish someone would ask when that fair share comes up is, well, what is a fair share? Our tax system in the U.S. is more progressive than Europe's. In other words, richer people pay a smaller share of the tax burden in the United States than they do in Europe. And the reason is Europe has what's called a value-added tax, which is effectively a national sales tax. That's one reason they can afford to have the welfare state that they do. So apparently, the Europeans think that the fair share is a little lower than ours. And the scary thing, and you've had politicians like Michael Bloomberg even say it. He said, you know, here in New York, we have a very small group of people that pay effectively all the cost. And if even a few of them leave, the state is going to be in trouble. And New York is beginning to face that. They're realizing, wait, we've had some wealthy people leave, and we're going to have a problem because they're paying the bills. If they're gone, we're really going to have a definite shortage in revenue.
And it's so disastrous for them, they even want to charge you to leave now. They've actually had proposals. Oh, you can go, but it's going to cost you this amount of money to get the hell out of here. It's just, oh, yeah, it's crazy.
Well, there are exit taxes, and I've had friends that have left New York, and they said when you leave, you have to be very careful that you don't have a storage unit in New York, you don't come back to New York for too many days a year, you make sure that your kids are enrolled in school elsewhere, because the state will relentlessly pursue you to try and get income tax from you.
Yeah, when you leave. All right, we'll be right back. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We've been talking about the tax structure in this country. And, Guy, I think you have some numbers for us.
Yeah, I know a lot of people like to talk about the top 1%. And, you know, maybe they do earn more than they should. They earn about 26% of the income in the U.S., but they pay 46% of the tax. So they are paying a pretty hefty tax. The top 10 earn 52% of the income on tax returns and pay 75% of the federal tax. And as we said before, the bottom 50 pay about 2% of all the tax. So, and earn 10% of the revenue. So we definitely tilt toward the higher income people paying more. And I guess fair is in the eye of the beholder, but we tax the higher income people far more than the Europeans do.
And, you know, this makes for a good, healthy conversation about where we're going in this country. And when we continue to talk about these giveaways, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and no one really knows how any of this is going to be paid for. And again, it all gets lost in the conversation for certain, right?
Well, and I think the one thing we forget is people that earn a lot of money, and Elon Musk is probably the poster child, he has created some things that are truly astounding. There wouldn't be an electric car business without Elon Musk. His Tesla brought electric cars to America. His Starlink system has connected the world to the internet, and now the airplanes are looking at using that for in-flight Wi-Fi because, you know, the existing systems are terrible. The Starlink works beautifully. You know, the same thing with SpaceX. He launched more spaceships into orbit last year than the entire rest of the world, and Boeing, a legacy carrier, couldn't get their astronauts back. SpaceX is going to do it. So, yeah, he made a lot of money, but he created a lot of value, and people were willing to pay for the services he created. And I think that's one of the things people forget about, the top 10%. They had to do something to earn the money.
And took on a lot of risk. Many of them could have gone bankrupt on any given day at any given time if things had not gone well for certain. As always, Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, we appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good to be with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Income people paying more, and I guess fair is in the eye of the beholder, but we tax the higher income people far more than the Europeans do.
And, you know, this makes for a good, healthy conversation about where we're going in this country. And when we continue to talk about these giveaways, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And no one really knows how any of this is going to be paid for. And again, it all gets lost in the conversation for certain, right?
Well, and I think the one thing we forget is people that earn a lot of money, and Elon Musk is probably the poster child. He has created some things that are truly astounding. There wouldn't be an electric car business without Elon Musk. His Tesla brought electric cars to America. his Starlink system has connected the world to the internet, and now the airplanes are looking at using that for in-flight Wi-Fi because, you know, the existing systems are terrible. The Starlink works beautifully. You know, the same thing with SpaceX. He launched more spaceships into orbit last year than the entire rest of the world. And Boeing, a legacy carrier, couldn't get their astronauts back. SpaceX is going to do it. So, yeah, he made a lot of money, but he created a lot of value, and people were willing to pay for the services he created. And I think that's one of the things people forget about, the top 10%. They had to do something to earn the money.
And took on a lot of risk. Many of them could have gone bankrupt on any given day at any given time if things had not gone well, for certain. As always, Guy Williams, President Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, we appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good to be with you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Sometimes in football, you need just a little more for that first down. You need to be pushing the pile. And on our new podcast, we'll give you that extra effort.
I'm Mike Renner, a longtime NFL analyst who helped develop player evaluation systems that every NFL team uses to this day.
And I'm Kyle Long, former All-Pro offensive lineman in the NFL who knows a thing or two about getting people moving.
You'll get expertise from inside the trenches and behind the tape for 4 episodes every week. So make sure you download and subscribe to the Pushing the Pile podcast on the Odyssey app.